Thanks, Jeremiah. Topping off the environmental news stories last week was the announcement by the Harper government that Thornhill MP Peter Kent would be Canada's newest environment minister. But Canadians should not conclude that a new minister signals any change in federal environment policy. For example, his opinion of the oil sands is clearly expressed in this clip from an interview he gave to CBC Television last Thursday.
We need to reassure the American administration and the American people that Canadian oil is ethical in every sense of the word. It's regulated. It is the product of a natural resource whose revenues don't go to fund terrorism or the destabilization of other governments.
But is your job to protect the oil sands, or is your job to protect the environment?
Well, but we're also doing this in terms of environmental control and oversight, the mitigation of negative effects of the exploitation, the legitimate exploitation of a wonderful Canadian resource. And also, it's ethical in the sense that the revenues gained from the development of the oil sands, the production of the oil sands, the sale of the oil, is shared with the people and the environment and the wildlife of the habitat.
In that same interview, Minister Kent pledged to continue the work of former Environment Ministers Jim Prentice and John Baird to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through regulation of the transportation sector. He also pledged to follow through on efforts to improve monitoring of impacts from oil sands mining on the Athabasca River, although he clearly rejected the notion that further development of the oil sands should be put on hold, at least until an adequate monitoring program is in place.
Moving to Toronto news, the approved light rail transit, or LRT plan, was under attack from the new mayor of Toronto, Rob Ford. Rob Ford's alternate plan would see an expansion of the current subway system instead of implementation of an LRT system to service underserved areas, stating a number of justifications for the alternate plan, primary among them being,
"Like it or not, cars are here to stay. Let's deal with it. It's time to stop the war on cars."
He also goes on to say that subway systems are faster, relating LRT systems to the current streetcar system in Toronto, and do not disrupt traffic as much since they have dedicated tracks. However, as pointed out in the Pembina Institute's analysis report of the options, these statements both seem to be a little misleading. While LRTs are slower, they are typically designed to stop less frequently than subways due to the reduced speed. And although the LRT is designed to ride on some current roadways, they do utilize dedicated lanes to remove them from normal traffic. The good news is that his plan will also add new pedestrian and cyclist dedicated trails, but that is likely just to get those pesky bikes off his roads.
"I can't support bike lanes. What I compare bike lanes to is swimming with the sharks. Sooner or later, you're going to get bitten. And, you know, I feel my heart bleeds for them when I hear someone gets killed, but it's their own fault at the end of the day."
In news from the Northwest, a study released by Environment Canada has found that owls are being poisoned by rodenticides used to control rat infestations in urban and agricultural areas. 70% of the owls examined from BC and the Yukon were found to contain traces of at least one rat poison in their livers. It is presumed that the owls are contaminated when they ingest poisoned rats. The poisoned rats may not die for days, potentially staggering around in open areas where they are easily caught by owls. Barn owls are one of the species affected by rodenticides. Last November, the Federal Committee on the Status of Endangered Wildlife in Canada listed the barn owl as endangered nationally and threatened in Western Canada, where an estimated 125 to 500 pairs remain. Meaning that this is a sound BC residents may be hearing less often in the future. Sophie Hindermark, who studied barn owl habitat at Simon Fraser University, recommends that people limit their use of rodenticides, applying them only in closed areas. A safer alternative is to use old-fashioned traps and to clean up garbage and other attractants that entice rats.
An explosion has injured 4 employees at the CNRL Horizon upgrader near the oil sands mine site by Fort McKay. The explosion reportedly shot flames hundreds of meters into the air around 3:30 in the afternoon of January 6th and was not isolated to the coker unit of the upgrader until 7 p.m. that following evening. The explosion comes in the wake of a number of other safety issues, In April of 2007, two Chinese workers were killed and four other men injured when the roof of a storage tank collapsed, resulting in 53 health and safety charges against CNRL and the Chinese contractor, the most ever laid in a workplace in Alberta. Another man had died at the site in September of 2008 when a floating backhoe tipped into the tailings pond. These ongoing safety issues should call into question CNRL's ability to operate a large mining and upgrading operation such as the one near Fort MacKay. The operations at the site have been indefinitely suspended.
And lastly, from Quebec, a provincial report found that 19 of 31 shale gas wells in the Lower St. Lawrence are leaking a substance referred to only as natural gas emissions. André Belize, president of the Quebec Association Against Atmospheric Pollution, suspects the emissions are mainly methane, a highly flammable gas that becomes explosive when mixed with air. Over a 20-year period, methane is 72 times more potent a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and it also contributes to ozone layer degradation. Such leaks are a common occurrence in shale gas mining, according to Hope DeVoe Henderson, a spokesman for Alberta-based Talisman Energy, who owns 11 of the wells cited in the provincial report. The natural gas deposits are trapped in shale bedrock and are extracted by a controversial mining process known as hydraulic fracturing, or fracking. Fracking was the subject of a recent documentary by Josh Fox called Gasland that exposes some of the health and environmental consequences of the U.S. boom in shale gas mining since 2005. Fracking is a relatively new process in Canada, and several environmental groups are calling for a moratorium. Earlier this year, the Quebec government commissioned a report on the shale gas industry, including recommendations on how it should be developed. That report is expected in February 2011. That's it for the review of this week's news. Back to you, Jeremiah.
If you're looking for more details about any of the environmental news stories that Rebecca and Andy mentioned, check out the links on our website, terrainforma.ca. Every week, we bring you a roundup of the week's top news stories. But if you're looking for more frequent updates, you can also subscribe to our Twitter feed or find us on Facebook. Today on Terra Informa, we once again head to Africa, this time to the iconic Serengeti National Park. This park is classic Africa. Big plains with herds of wildebeest, lions, zebras, and many more, all in staggering abundance. Its conservation is a celebrated success, but now a proposed new highway could place that in jeopardy. Terra Informa correspondent Dave Kaskan journeyed to Serengeti, Tanzania, to explore the details behind this controversy.
Welcome to the Serengeti, Tanzania. If you've ever watched a wildlife documentary, or even the film The Lion King, you'll be familiar with this landscape that I'm looking at right now. Serengeti means endless plain in the local Maasai language. And from where I'm sitting in this bumpy four-wheel drive, I would say that that name, endless plain, is entirely appropriate. So right now, I'm looking at a great expanse of grassland, flat mainly, but with some low rocky hills in the distance across the brown grass, and there's scattered trees on the horizon also. This plain, this endless plain, is also the perfect home for some of Africa's most iconic animals. But I'll get out of our car up here and provide some background on our story today. We've pulled over for a minute near a waterhole now, and there's quite a lot of bird life, as you can hopefully hear in the background. The Serengeti is one of the natural wonders of the world. This massive grassland ecosystem in northeast Tanzania is home to one of the greatest wildlife spectacles on the planet. Every year, over 2 million herbivores journey over 800 kilometres in a great circular route to find the best pastures and to give birth. It's the setting for countless wildlife documentaries and provided the inspiration for the Disney hit The Lion King. Oh, I just can't wait to be king. Oh, I just can't wait. But today, this iconic park is under threat from a highway proposed by the Tanzanian government. 50 kilometres of the new two-lane highway is proposed to pass through the park, slicing through the migration route. Scientists and conservationists are warning of grave danger to the ecosystem. In mid-December, an activist group, the African Network for Animal Welfare, filed a court action against the highway in Tanzania to stop the project. Anyhow, today on Terra Informa, we're taking a tour of this iconic wildlife mecca, and we're trying to understand the story behind the controversy. Whilst I've been here in Tanzania, there's been a presidential election. They come around every 5 years. And this year, the incumbent promised a highway to people in the far northeast of the country at this last election. The highway would reach from Arusha, one of the larger cities in Tanzania, to the shores of Lake Victoria, an area which is less developed compared to the rest of the country. And it's worth keeping this in perspective. Tanzania is a very poor country, one of the poorest in the world. It's in the bottom 10%, in fact. So it's not hard to imagine why a new highway is tempting to many people. But despite the country's poverty, Tanzania has an amazing park system. Regular listeners to Terra Informa might remember our previous report from Amani Nature Reserve, a rainforest park in Tanzania. But broadly speaking, about one-third of the country is under some kind of protection, and the more prominent of these are protected pretty well. Of these parks, Serengeti is the jewel in the crown. Tourists flock here, and they bring some serious dollars with them. In 2011, the country hopes to attract over 1 million visitors and $1.7 billion in tourist revenues. And those numbers are entirely plausible given this year's numbers. These tourists generally come to see the big game. Buffalo, wildebeest, lions, zebra, leopards, elephant, giraffe, and many others. The bird life also is spectacular, as you can probably hear where I'm standing right now. But it's the wildebeest that are the key to all of this. Each year, about 500,000 of these animals are born on the plains. They consume about half the total grass produced in the Serengeti. In one day, the massive herds will produce 500 truckloads of manure, which fertilizes the grass again. Furthermore, the wildebeest provide food for predators such as lions. The proposed highway would be crossed by 1.5 million wildebeest on their annual migration. But scientists think that many of them would stop migrating. In Canada, we have something of a precedent. Banff National Park is home to a large number of deer and elk. The highway bisecting the park, the Transnational Highway, interrupts this. And even with the special animal passes, which were built over the highway, animal numbers have been reduced considerably. Unfortunately, even if such wildlife bridges were a silver bullet solution in such cases, they wouldn't really be feasible in this park due to the sheer numbers of animals on the move. But here's the really worrying bit for the Serengeti. If there are fewer wildebeest, there's more grass. If there's more grass, there are more grass fires. The fires could kill trees and reduce the productivity of the ecosystem. And, furthermore, there would be less prey for the big game to hunt. After all, many animals call a wildebeest dinner. Because of these and other predicted effects, a high-profile article in the journal Nature warned of collapse of the entire ecosystem. But there might be a solution. An alternative highway route has been proposed, far to the south, skirting the park's boundaries. However, the government has already laid out survey markers for its preferred northern route through the park, which is the shorter route. Unless pressure from Tanzanian and international environmental groups can persuade a change of mind, the Serengeti's days as a pristine wilderness might be in jeopardy. In the meantime, I'm going to get back to hunting for rhino with my binoculars. Thanks for joining me on Safari. Terra Informa will keep you updated on the future for the Serengeti.
Thanks, Dave. In case you forgot, you're listening to Terra Informa, your weekly source for environmental news. Catch us every week on the airways across Canada or stream us from our website, terrainforma.ca. In recent years, environmental groups have been waging pitched battles to save lakes across Canada from destruction by mining companies. Under legislation introduced in 2000, firms can apply to have natural water bodies redesignated as tailings impoundment areas by the federal government. Steve Anderson filed this report.
Thanks, Jeremiah. Well, a bit of a hang-up on this report, I'm afraid. I talked to members of Mining Watch Canada and the Sierra Club, who've been working on the issue of this legislation which permits mining companies to dump their waste into natural lakes. Unfortunately, lining up an interview with the federal government has proven a little more challenging. So we're going to hold off on this story until next week, but I do want to give you a taste of what's coming up. Here's Ramsey Hart of Mining Watch Canada and Angela Giles of the Council of Canadians. What happens to the lake once the company begins dumping these materials into it?
The aquatic ecosystem will pretty much collapse. The amount of solids, so the fine particles that are in tailings, as well as the metals that are contained with them, really don't allow for aquatic life to exist, especially during the dumping process. After the mine is finished and the lake is no longer being used as an impoundment, there's, you know, some debate about what would happen to these lakes, whether or not they would ever be able to be returned to functioning aquatic ecosystems again.
It's shocking to think that in a developed country that we would be allowing corporations to destroy something that is so valuable to life. And it's something that we believe should be a human right. You know, water, access to water should be a human right. And that we're just taking for granted the fact that that we have lakes available to us, that corporations should just be allowed to destroy something that exists for the good of all.
For those full interviews and an in-depth look at the practice of dumping mine tailings into natural water bodies, be sure to tune in next week. And if you've had personal experience with one of these projects, we'd love to hear your story. Drop us a line at area code 780-492-2577, extension 236. All right, I'm going to hand things straight over to Rebecca, who's got a piece on grizzly bear diets.
Today I'm speaking with Oliver Barker, who's a master's student at the University of Alberta. Welcome, Oliver.
Thanks.
So what's your main research question?
What I'm looking at is sort of the feeding ecology of grizzly bears in the Mackenzie Delta. It's an area in the northwestern corner of the Northwest Territories.
And why are you interested in grizzly bear diets?
We're looking at this for a number of reasons. Mostly what we're doing is trying to establish a baseline, or trying to find out what grizzlies are eating now and what's important, because there's going to be a lot of change taking place in the Mackenzie Delta. Firstly, there's the climate is changing very rapidly in that area. As well, there's going to be a great deal of oil and gas development in the very near future in that area. In the next 2 to 5 years, there's going to be the beginning of a pipeline and some natural gas extraction facilities. So there are two reasons that we're looking at what grizzlies are eating now and what's important for grizzlies to eat now. First of all, we'd like to find out what they're eating now so that we can compare that to anything that might change in the future. So under an altered climate or after pipelines and extraction facilities have been built. And we're also finding out what they're eating now and where the sort of most important places are for them to gather food, so that we can potentially protect those areas and maybe develop elsewhere if there's a key feeding area that's scheduled for development.
Okay, so what are some of the predicted impacts of this natural gas extraction from the Mackenzie Delta?
Well, what it's going to mean for the bears, for the most important thing for the bears, I think, is that there are going to be a lot of people in a place where there really weren't any people spending much time before. So the bears are, their population is currently stable. They don't interact with humans very much. However, once this development starts, you get a lot of construction, you get a lot of maintenance, and you'll also get increased access to areas that we didn't have access in the past.
Do you anticipate the roads are having an impact on the diet of the grizzlies?
What will happen is that, and it happened in the past, bears don't like to spend time near where there are people. So if you get a road going through, or a pipeline going through an area, what you end up with is a sort of a much larger area around that road or pipeline that the bears tend to avoid. The other possible problem is that bears could get in trouble at work camps. They're certainly known to get into garbage or to pull down fences and that sort of thing. And if that's the case, then you end up with bears being killed because they're problem bears.
Based on your preliminary results so far, before the disturbance from the pipeline and with sort of climate change as it has proceeded to date, what are the grizzly bears up there eating?
There seems to be a wide variation in what individual bears eat in that area. There are a lot of bears that are primarily vegetarian. They're eating roots and berries and sedges and horsetails. There are other bears that seem to be able to find quite a bit of meat to eat. They're eating things like dead whales and seals that have washed up from the Beaufort Sea, Arctic ground squirrels, beavers. There are also a lot of moose in that area, so they may be able to get moose calves, but that's something I haven't seen.
So how do you know what they're eating? Is it based on, do you witness them consuming the food, or do you use stable isotopes to try and look at their diet, or are you looking at gut contents?
Because it's such a remote area and getting out and around there is so expensive, you have to use a helicopter. They very rarely see bears that are actually in the process of eating something. As well, it's hard to sneak up on a bear. The helicopter is quite loud. The way that we were finding out what they're eating, there's sort of three methods of doing it. We could look at scat, been doing stable isotope work, so looking at sort of what kind of ratio of plant to animal matter they've been eating, and also what kind of ratio to terrestrial versus marine food they're eating. And we're also looking at grizzly movement and finding out what areas they're spending a lot of time in, and then from that inferring what they're eating, because we have an idea of where the distribution of ground squirrels and of vegetation and other food sources.
Okay, so are ground squirrels an important component of the diet?
That's part of what I'm working on. It seems like because there's so much individuality in bear diet up there, that some bears may be using ground squirrels quite heavily, and other bears don't seem to be using them at all.
Well, it sounds really interesting, and it sounds like it's important to sort of set this baseline before the Mackenzie Pipeline development proceeds. So good luck with your research, and thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, thanks for giving me the opportunity.
You're listening to Terra Informa. Up next, Brett Taggart with a report on keeping your house warm and environmentally friendly through the winter. Here in icy Canada, trying to reduce your home's energy use in wintertime can leave you and your family in the cold. Keeping your house warm without fossil fuels or extra electricity is possible. Today, Brett takes a look at passive solar heating solutions you can add to an existing home, and at a new technology that could generate electricity using the windows in your house.
When you think of solar energy, you're probably thinking of solar panels. And with good reason. They're sleek, flashy, and seemingly magical devices that produce electricity from daylight. Here in Canada, solar panels are a mixed solution. Our short summers and shorter winter days just don't give us enough daylight for our current energy consumption. What we can do is improve the efficiency of our homes and lifestyles, with the aim of lowering consumption to the energy level that sustainable resources can supply. Passive solar heating uses the sun's energy directly to heat homes and other buildings. Unlike active solar heating, passive solar heating does not involve turning the solar energy into electricity. The most basic example of passive solar heating is well-positioned windows. Large windows in the southern wall of a building allow a high amount of heat from the sun into your home on sunny days, reducing your energy consumption. Using insulated windows and curtains that can be closed at night, you can maximize the heat you retain after the sun goes down, keeping your house warm without consuming any energy. Another good way to maximize your absorption of solar heat is with dark colors. For example, a roof painted black will get hot much faster than lighter colors and transmit the most passive solar heat into the building. Also, dense materials such as water or concrete store solar heat and release it much more slowly than air. A simple method of storing passive solar heat involves placing a large array of barrels or jars of water in dark containers inside a building where the sun will hit them during the day. The water heats up slowly over the course of the day, then releases the heat equally slowly during the cooler hours. Here in Edmonton, the Mill Creek Net Zero Project House is a model of passive solar design. Combining a heat-catching design with large southern windows and a heat-retaining structure built of concrete, the house is able to absorb 54% of its space heat through passive solar energy, without any moving parts or consuming energy. The house is equipped with movable awnings to shade those heat-catching windows during summer, and the thick insulating walls will keep the place cool. The Net Zero Project has the advantage of building from scratch, but what about refitting your existing home? If you have major renovations in mind, improving your home's insulation is the most effective way to reduce your energy consumption. Installing better insulated windows and walls will create an immediate impact. Other retrofits, such as improving your home's roof insulation and material to maximize solar absorption, will help keep costs down and the temperature up. New technology can help turn passive absorption designs into active absorption ones. A new type of transparent solar film developed by the U.S. Department of Energy could turn windows into clean electricity generators. Harnessing the power of the sun means placing solar collection devices where they're most likely to be in direct contact with its rays. For many years, that ideal place has been the roofs of homes and businesses, but newer technologies are aimed at expanding this range to windows as well. Passive solar designs are particularly well suited to this technology, having already maximized their design for solar availability. The scientists have created a new type of self-assembling, transparent thin film that could boost the cost-effectiveness and scalability of solar windows. When applied to the surface under carefully controlled conditions, the material self-assembles in a repeating pattern of tiny hexagon-shaped cells resembling a honeycomb. The densely packed edges of the honeycomb strongly absorb light and facilitate electrical conductivity, while the centers don't absorb much light and are transparent. This means the film can be used over windows to generate electricity and retain heat without blocking your view outside. But a solar window is not the only way. Someone's trying to do the same thing with Venetian blinds. The solar panel Venetian blind design by Vincent Gerkens is a green technology that captures solar energy during the day and releases it at night. The concept uses a flexible solar cell that fits over the surface of the Venetian blinds along with an electroluminescent neon foil to transmit the solar power back into light again. The solar energy captured by the blinds could be fed back into the house's power grid, helping reduce electrical consumption. Passive solar heating can dramatically improve your home's efficiency. Better insulation and heat-retaining materials will maximize the energy we must use, and passive solar absorption designs can reduce the load on your furnace. Soon, we may even be able to power our homes with large, sun-catching windows. Staying warm in the middle of winter has never seemed so inviting.
Thanks, Brett. Well, that about wraps it up for the first Terraforma show of 2011. We'll be back next week with more environmental news, and in the meantime, why don't you head over to our website, terrainforma.ca. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard on Terra Informa, look us up on Facebook or drop us a line at terra, T-E-R-R-A, at cgsr.com. I've been your host, Jeremiah Bolstad. Till next week, and thanks for listening.
Today on Wings, news of women activists across the world, what they are up against, and what they have been risking.
The ruling provoked a gut-wrenching scene from the grieving mother who had spent her own time, energy, and limited resources performing work that should have been done by professional police investigators.
I don't really even trust the media to portray this well either, actually, and I think we're really going to have to do it for ourselves here.
You have to look at the change of attitude.
We wanted to let them know this is a new day in terms of how this community is going to respond to the police lack of involvement and lack of approach in investigating the murders and disappearances.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Our first story today is from Mexico, where a mother took on the system of impunity for femicide. She lost. The story is shocking, but it needs to be told. Shannon Young reports.
The mother of a young woman murdered in Ciudad Juarez was herself killed in an event that has sparked condemnation from the United Nations Office of the High Commissioner of Human Rights, Amnesty International, and a range of organizations inside of Mexico.
Pero hasta el último aliento de vida que yo tenga, voy a luchar hasta que a mi hija se le haga justicia.
Maricela Escobedo may not have known just how right she was when she told reporters in May that she would fight for justice for her daughter until her last breath. Escobedo was shot in the back of the head at point-blank range the night of Thursday, December 16, 2010, as she carried out a sit-in protest in front of the governor's palace in Chihuahua City, capital of the state in which Ciudad Juarez is located. She had been camped out in the park across the street from the palace for a week and a half, vowing not to move until authorities captured the confessed killer of her daughter, Ruby Freire Escobedo.
Yo no he escuchado de todas las madres de jóvenes desaparecidas.